Hey everybody, so you'll notice in this episode there's some references to Halloween. Obviously, we're way past Halloween. As I mentioned in the last show, I got behind on everything and had to put the podcast a little bit on the sideline. So most of this episode isn't about Halloween, so you'll be fine. It's just you'll hear references. Otherwise, of course, as I say every episode, we really appreciate support. So if you want to support this show, you can either send us $1 billion, which would be great because then all of us could retire, or you can go to audibletrial.com/skiffyandfanty, sign up for a 1-month free trial membership, get your free audiobook, try it out, continue the service if you love it, all that good stuff. Lots of cool stuff up there that you can check out. So audibletrial.com/skiffyandfanty. And on that note, I'm going to shut up and let you guys get to the episode.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But DeKrell forgot one thing, yes. Monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
Exterminate!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown. T-5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanny Show, episode 119.
Science fiction futures that terrify, just in time for Halloween.
I'm Sean.
I'm Paul.
And our special guests today are Jason Sanford.
Hey.
And Gareth Powell.
Hello.
So, we should start by going over some of the cool stuff that Gareth and Jason have going on. So, Gareth does have a novel coming out, I believe, in December.
January the 3rd.
Oh, no, you moved it to you just messing up my whole schedule.
I didn't move it. Amazon are just somewhat over-optimistic.
Okay. So, January 3rd, and why don't you tell us a little bit about that book?
Okay, it's a book which doesn't really fall into any recognizable genre because it's kind of like a noir detective murder mystery that takes place in an alternate France involving a cigar-smoking, spitfire-flying monkey.
Okay.
I love it already. It just sounds like so much fun.
I hope it is because if it doesn't live up to the hype, I'm going to be crucified.
Cool. So do you have anything sort of on the way in between that we should be aware of?
In between? Oh, come on. How long do you think it takes to write a novel? No.
Look, 48 hours. It tops. Yeah.
72.
Maybe 72. Yeah.
Yeah. No, that one's... That's the next one that's going to hit print. I've just had a couple of stories out in a couple of anthologies. There's the Solaris Books in the UK have stuck out an ebook-only anthology called Solaris Rising 1.5 to plug a gap between two print anthologies called Solaris Rising 1 and Solaris Rising 2. They put out a 1.5, so that's available from Solaris Books. Loads of great writers, loads of great stories, and me tagging along on there. Shirt tails. So that's worth going. Apart from that, I'm scribbling away on the next novel length projects at the moment.
Perfect. Cool. Now, Jason, what have you got going on?
Well, I've got a 12,000 word novelette coming out in InnerZone in I think just a week or two. It'll be in their November-December issue. It's called Mirror Blink, far future science fiction story. And I've got, if you go to my website, jasonsanford.com, you can see the amazing art that Warwick Fraser Combe has done for the story. It's, I think it's the best art anyone's ever made for one of my stories, so I'm really excited to see it in print. I've got some other stories coming out early next year, I believe in the March issue of Asimov's. I have a story called Monday's Monk. Again, it's a science fiction story. And then I've got other stories I'm working on. Big thing, though, is I'm plugging away at the second draft of a novel. So I've got the thing finished. Unfortunately, it was a little bit drafty. So it's being reworked and trying to stop all those leaks.
Oh, Fantastic. So hopefully we'll have a novel from you within the next year.
Yes, it looks like it might actually happen this time.
Sweet. Awesome. So, okay, and Paul, like, he doesn't do anything interesting, so. That was supposed to be amusing. I'm sorry. I pick on you, Paul. But in any case, everybody knows about Paul. So, okay. All right, so our topics, we had two topics. One was kind of more of a throwaway because Gareth was going to be on here, and since he's obviously from across the pond, it seemed fitting that we would talk about Ian M. Banks, his comments in a recent Guardian Books sort of interview in which he suggested kind of flippantly that that the British science fiction tradition is more serious than the American one. And I was curious what people here had thought of that.
Go ahead,
Gareth.
Sorry, I just accidentally disconnected myself from the Skype call while you were asking the question. I just had to reconnect there.
Okay, so I should re-ask the question?
Yeah.
Okay. So I'll just redo the little bit. So for our first topic, it was kind of a throwaway topic, partly because Gareth is on here, because he is obviously from across the pond. And it was a comment by Ian M. Banks in a Guardian Books podcast interview in which he suggested somewhat flippantly that British SF as a tradition, science fiction as a tradition in England, is more serious than the American tradition. And I was wanting to get everyone's kind of impression of that, whether you agree or whether maybe you thought he was saying it kind of not really seriously or what have you, or if you do agree, why you agree.
So. Well, I'd just say, speaking as a writer in Britain and a writer who's just written a novel about a smoking monkey, that SF in Britain is definitely very serious.
Okay, you have to.
I detect
explain.
Notes of sarcasm.
Yeah. So do you disagree with that assessment then?
No, I absolutely agree with it. I mean, Ian himself, if you read the culture novels, they're full of drones and hyper-intelligent spaceships that are never sarcastic and absolutely never make god-awful puns during the course of a novel. So I think we take it all very, very seriously. Except, obviously, we don't. But I think what he was getting at is that there is, in the UK, a much closer love-hate relationship between genre fiction and mainstream fiction than possibly there is in the States. I'm not entirely sure what the relationship is in the States, but there's a lot of writers in the UK, like M. John Harrison, John Courtney Greenwood, who kind of have a sort of uneasy relationship with the mainstream, that there's a lot more crossover and a lot more sort of elbow rubbing going on than possibly there is in the States, where genre seems to be a slightly sort of much more self-contained entity.
And perhaps even more commercial as in the way that it's constructed.
Yeah, possibly.
Actually, I agree with that about how the United States looks at genre fiction, because there's a much bigger divide here than I think there is in England. You don't see, literary writers dipping into pure science fiction and jumping back and forth over here, where it's, hey, this book is totally science fiction, this one is not. Over here, you see a lot of literary writers like Cormac McCarthy and others who write pure genre fiction, but when they write it, it's somehow as if pulled magically from their ass. It becomes not genre. Hey, I write Cormac McCarthy writes an apocalyptic novel, The Road, wins the Pulitzer Prize. There's no way that is genre fiction. So you don't, even though the literary writers over here engage in quite a bit of genre fiction writing, for some reason the literary establishment seems to kind of turn a blind eye to that actually being, cases of genre fiction. That said, I think, among the genre writers, there's, both here and in England and the United States, you have the same level of, you know, of stories. You have great stories, you have bad stories, you have commercial stories, you have crappy stories, you have the whole range of stuff. But I think there is indeed a different attitude towards how genre fiction fits in over here. You know, it lingers. It seems like it's always genre fiction's been a lot more accepted for a much longer time in Europe and in England in particular.
Yeah, I think I would agree with some rare exceptions, which they're not appearing in my brain at the moment. But it does seem like even what Garrett was saying, with some of the examples that he presented are authors who do actually intentionally cross. I mean, Ian M. Banks is an obvious example. He writes as a mainstream quote unquote literary author and also as a science fiction author. He's both. And it was interesting in that same interview, I mean, when people asked him, you know, when are you going to write another culture novel? And he's like, I'm going to write another literary novel because I like jumping back and forth. Whereas you don't get that so much here. I mean, it would be somewhat strange, I think, if Larry Niven decided suddenly, you know what, I'm going to write a novel like J.K. Rowling wrote recently. You know, not genre in any way, just maybe a good old-fashioned cozy mystery.
You do see a good bit of, I mean, there are a number of authors over here who cross over, you know, write in the different genres. You have science fiction authors who write mysteries and write everything, but it's just not as accepted. A lot of them use pseudonyms when they do it.
That's true.
So it just seems like the over in the United States, it's just, there's a strong preference to keep our genres separate, damn it. You know, what is science fiction will not cross into fantasy, will not cross into the literary, will not cross into the dang mystery. And, you know, I like that there's a lot of blurring. Now, you do have authors who have blurred it. Ray Bradbury is a classic example of a science fiction author who became very, accepted by the mainstream literary establishment. But, you know, I don't see an Ian Banks-type author in the United States. I don't see any being able to do what he's doing. So, but I say more power to him. It's great.
I think it's at the level of the short story where you're seeing some of that blending of genre in the United States as opposed to the UK. People like Rachel Swirsky, for example, are bringing literary values into genre or bringing genre out into a more borderland between genre and the mainstream. But it's nothing like the UK where you have Ian Banks flipping back and forth at will or J.K. Rowling writing a straight-up literary novel with no Hogwarts or magic whatsoever. But the U.S., I think there is that mutual suspicion, shall we say, between genre and literary establishments staring each other over a high wall, which is slowly being broken down, but much more slowly, I think, than in Britain and the rest of the world.
And that still really is bizarre to me. I'm an academic, a writer, and, well, I should say I'm mostly an academic because that's the only thing I've been successful at. But you know, as a writer and an academic, for me, I used to think that the academic world was very anti-genre, right? It was, you know, mainstream literary fiction, that was it. But that tide has pretty much dissipated. Like, it's come and gone now. I mean, I'm in a program that is, like, in a really cozy, incestuous relationship with genre. And a lot of programs across the country are like that. They're playing with genre. I mean, it's almost expected that a lot of people are going to be messing with pop culture in some way, whether it's genre fiction or some other aspect. But yet we don't see that quite the same way in the writing world, which seems so strange to me when it used to be academia was the one that was holding sci-fi back. And now it's not so much holding it back. It's sort of like genre fiction is kind of holding itself back or is being held back by something else or just doesn't feel like taking on the challenge of just doing that kind of insane. I mean, there are obviously exceptions, but it doesn't seem like it's as much of a tradition. Whereas you look at British authors, I mean, Gareth was mentioning some, and then you can go even outside of SF to like China Mieville or other names that are going to now completely blank on me. But there are all these kinds of authors that are really sort of, maybe this is the wrong way of saying it, but almost like adding a kind of serious seriousness to the literature of SF and F that makes it seem like it's a valuable medium of writing that anybody can partake in, as it were, and it's not going to destroy your career, that kind of thing. I don't know if that came out the way it should have, but whatever.
I think that kind of goes back in the UK to right back to the roots of the genre itself, back to sort of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, H.G. Wells, where they were literary characters, and that was just the genre tropes they were inventing there were just other means of expressing themselves, and they weren't taken as a separate literature at all, but just a different way of commenting on the world around them and the issues around them, like Mary Shelley commenting on science and religious issues and so on, just using what has now become like a classic horror story or a classic genre story. But at the time, it was just a metaphor.
I agree, yet again, I don't want to be sounding like I'm being a yes man over here, but I agree with Gareth. I mean, England really, I mean, it's amazing how it's a different attitude towards the acceptance of science fiction and its role in literature. And I think that still shows up because, in my personal opinion, I mean, some of the best science fiction, especially, but fantasy too, is coming out of England. And for example, and not just that, but is being published. Like InnerZone is my flat out favorite science fiction magazine.
Yeah, but you're biased because they publish you.
Okay.
I agree with you though. As someone who's not published in InnerZone, I think they are one of the top, easily top three SF magazines out there. Period.
But you want to know why they publish my stories? The stories they were publishing the last few years are stories that were rejected by every American science fiction magazine. You know, now I'm starting to get some published because I built a reputation in InnerZone. But you know, the stories I was writing did not find a home over in the United States at first. And I think that is because of the types of stories that InnerZone and the publishers over there are looking for. It's a different style of stories. I mean, Ack Ack Macaque is a great story. And I'm just curious, did you submit that to Asimov's or any of the other American magazines first? Or I don't know if they would have taken it right back then.
I don't know if they would have done or not. I have to admit, I submitted that to InterZone first because they had just accepted another one of my stories, so that which was the first professional story I had. So I followed it up quick with another one. But I very rarely submit to Asimov's or Analog or any of the American stories because. There just isn't. I think a lot of British writing has a different kind of sensibility, and there seems to be some kind of translational disconnect between the two. Whereas, in not that I think translational disconnect is actually a real phrase, but we'll go with it. Because especially in sort of Analog, there is a kind of an American tradition of SF stemming from
right.
Robert Heinlein, perhaps, whereas the British SF writers at the moment are probably stemming more from J.G. Ballard.
Mm, well put, yeah.
Ooh, yeah, and Ballard is good.
And I do want to say, though, I mean, before anybody takes it the wrong way, there is some great science fiction being published in the United States, and Asimov's is publishing some great science fiction, too. Sheila Williams is really bringing in, in fact, she's publishing some of the authors that first found a home in InnerZone, which I find. You can find the same types of science fiction in the United States, but it's harder, you know, to find in some ways. It's not a. I don't know. It's like in the current issue of InnerZone, there's Lavi Tidhar's story, which I absolutely loved.
And Tidhar's good.
Oh yes, he is.
I know. And this story, Strigrio, I'm not even sure how to say it. I just could not see another science fiction magazine in the United States publishing that story. And, you know, it got me, you know, now some of the online magazines, you know, Clark's World,
yeah, that's the exception I was going to offer.
That's
kind of
the exception. And Asimov's is an exception, too, in some ways. But, you know, you've got, like Gareth was saying, you've got the hard science fiction tradition of Analog. You've got Gardner Dozois, the legacy he built up at Asimov's. There were certain types of fiction that were published, and if you didn't write in those traditions, you're kind of screwed.
Didn't Stanley Schmidt admit that he was retiring from Analog?
Yeah,
he did.
So he's retiring.
So do we know, I didn't look, but I'm wondering, do we know who's going to take over for him?
Yes, it's his assistant editor, who's been at Analog for a decade or more. So I don't think the editorial taste at Analog would change extensively, but I could be wrong.
Yeah, because that's what I was really curious about, is if there would be a slight shift. Because that's the thing, is I do kind of wonder, like, when people are editors of a single magazine for so long, not that this is necessarily a bad thing, it's actually good that they can do it for so long, but it does make you wonder, like, how does that person keep their taste relevant when they're, especially for something like Analog, which looks for a very particular kind of science fiction, right? It looks for hard SF. I mean, how do you keep your taste kind of progressing and changing with the times without kind of getting trapped? That would be an interesting question actually to ask Stanley Schmidt. But
oh, absolutely. And I don't want to knock on Analog too. I mean, they published they were my first professional science fiction acceptance. That was also the only story of mine they've taken, because I just don't write a lot of the stories that are in that vein. But, you know, not to knock those types of stories, you know, it's just...
No, yeah.
You know, I mean, I love hard science fiction also, and it's just sometimes I love hard science fiction that could be, you know, sometimes you... I don't know, there's... I like to have a broader definition of what hard science fiction could be sometimes than what you see in some of the United States traditions.
Yeah, I agree with that. That's something like... I'm trying to articulate this in a way that doesn't make me sound like a moron.
Go for it.
I do think that sometimes, with the exception maybe of some of the online magazines, that SF has a tendency, either in the U.S., and I'm saying from the U.S. because that's the largest market for short fiction in particular, that it has a tendency to kind of not want to push the envelope. Like, in some sense, like, there are some authors who obviously break this tradition, whether they're British or otherwise, but it seems like, from a particular perspective, that Britain right now, England and its other and outlying areas, and even Commonwealth writers, they're having what appears to me to be like almost like a new renaissance in genre, broadly defined. Whereas in the U.S., I don't quite see like we don't have our new wave moment right now. No. And I feel like, and I use new wave not necessarily that we need another new wave per se, but that there needs to be what is the next kind of boom for us? I mean, I've heard many people talk about British SF and fantasy as being in a boom period right now, and it seems to be. I mean, good lord, Mieville in like a decade became this immense figure.
Yes.
I mean, even other. I mean, Ian Banks is considered even to be possibly one of the most important SF writers of our time right now.
Right.
It's just a boom. It's a huge boom of amazing work coming out of the UK. I mean, even Lavi Tidar's Osama. Which, right. I don't even know what the hell you would, what genre you'd stick that in, but whatever. I could never see that getting published in the U.S. Not in a million years, just because of its subject matter.
Yeah.
Even though it is possibly one of the best books ever written on that particular subject.
I agree.
So.
And it got totally overlooked by all the awards, except for, I think, the British Fantasy Award.
Yeah, it got nominated for a few things. But not in any, like, it didn't really get any attention in any of the major U.S. awards.
Not in the United States.
No. And that to me is a complete tragedy, because that book is,
right.
I think if it got more attention, it could be like that one book that we remember from the 2010s period, you know, that one book that just shattered the world. Yeah. Mieville had the 2010s. Kid. Anyway, Garrett, did you want to add anything else to this particular topic?
I think what you say about a renaissance going on is maybe a grand way to describe it, but there are certainly a generation of sci-fi writers coming up behind Ian Banks who have got are crossing boundaries. It's not just British; it's kind of slightly wider European as well. You have Aliette de Bodard writing her sort of Aztec murder mystery. Fantasies. You've got Adam Christopher, originally from New Zealand, now living in the UK, writing Empire State and Seven Wonders, sort of reinventing the superhero in a literary canon. You've got Lauren Bucas from South Africa. Right, Moxieland, Zoo City. You know, first one is just rebooting cyberpunk. The second one is doing urban fantasy the way it should be done. You know, there's this whole generation of young sort of 30s, early 40s writers just suddenly all breaking at the same time.
and I think it's very exciting because none of them are specifically pinned downable to a specific genre. They're kind of taking the bits they want from each genre.
I do find it interesting, though. I harp on InnerZone, but InnerZone and its sister publication, Black Static, are publishing so many of these authors. And another one I'd add to the list you mentioned is Nina Allen. And, you know, amazing authors who, you're right, it's hard to peg them down. But what they're doing is, I'm just not seeing the same thing happening among across the genre here in the United States, you know, so...
I wonder
doesn't mean there aren't writers here doing that, but I mean, as a general trend, I'm not seeing it.
I wonder sorry, go ahead, Gareth.
I was just going to say, I think there might be a little more freedom on this side of the pond in terms of once you write a space opera, you're pretty much pegged as a space opera writer. You have to keep churning out the same books over and over again. Well, whereas over here, we have the kind of the mid-level publishers like Solaris, who publish me, and Angry Robot as well, who publish Adam and Aliette, who are very, very keen on expanding the boundaries of the genres that they're publishing. Angry Robot especially, they're loving the cross-genre stuff. They're really pushing it. So I think, for me, I remember speaking to Alistair Reynolds at one point, who said he wanted to do all sorts of different stuff, but once he got a very successful space opera, he was kind of told by the publisher, well, we want some more big thick books and spaceships on the cover. And I was a bit worried about that, because I was, you know, I wrote two space operas in a row, and I thought, I'll go out and write a monkey book.
And now you might get stuck with that. You might be that monkey book guy.
You'll be cigar-smoking monkey man.
But my next novel, it might be another space opera. It might be, you know, it might be something completely different. It might be a murder mystery set in Atlantis. I don't know. But I think that there are the kind of the more agile publishers like Solaris, Angry Robot. There are others over here who will go with that genre and who will not kind of try and peg authors into marketing categories.
I think that over here, that might be something we're seeing in YA, where YA is just one big amorphous category where you're getting all sorts of different parts of genre getting thrown in together without any really differentiation. In genre, we have hard SF, social SF, fantasy, epic fantasy, sword and sorcery, urban fantasy, and all that. But YA just seems to be a big pot that people are being thrown into or dipping out of, and I think that's maybe where that tradition from the British side is showing up here, although in smaller and not yet as in a more inchoate form, if that makes any sense.
Oh yes, I hadn't thought about that before, but now that you mentioned it, I could see young adult fantasy and science fiction. It's kind of all. It's not the hard barrier is not there. Which does tend to tell me that in the future, as the kids who are reading those books grow up, that maybe they'll take along their openness to the different types of fiction and keep it as an adult. So then maybe that's a good thing for the genre over here.
Yeah, and it's something that Paul had made me wonder is, I really wonder about what the difference between book cultures are in the UK and the US. Because I can't speak to it because I've not spent enough time in the UK to have any sort of reasonable sense of that. And I'm guessing Gareth has not spent enough time in the US to make an assessment the other way. But it would be interesting if anybody has done maybe an examination of where book culture is in the US as opposed to the UK and vice versa, to see to some extent, I mean, how readers actually engage with the books that they're reading. And how that might have some influence on the kinds of things that get published. Because when you think about the publishing industry, I mean, it is, we all understand, essentially a commercial industry. It's there to make profit, more or less, with some exceptions. But essentially it wants to make money so that it can keep printing more books to make more money. And in the U.S., it seems like there's such an enormous trend in U.S. publishing towards just publishing whatever the hell will sell, right? No matter the quality, per se, right? We need big, just amazing books that are sold a million copies. And maybe to some extent, the kinds of cultures that produce that that commercialization maybe has an impact on the kinds of things that are published in both in the different areas, the different parts of the world. I don't know if that is. That's kind of like a random, unfounded hypothesis. But it would seem to me on some level that has to have something to do with it.
I think that's definitely true because over here I've met a lot of the people that work for the publishing houses in the UK, sort of Simon Spanton at Glance, Mark Gascoigne, Lee Harris at Angry Robot, John Oliver at Solaris, so on, so on, Joe Walton at Quercus. And these people all really care incredibly passionately about the subject matter, about the genre, about and about the writers that are coming through. And they really, really, really want to stick out damn good books, all of them. It's, you know, these are people that have grown up with genre and they come into the publishing game to publish damn good books, and they haven't come in to shift units. And although that is part of their everyday job, their hearts are on their sleeves when it comes to working with writers that they really see doing something good in the genre. And I think that the readers, judging from the conventions they go to, really respond to that. And it's the analogy I come up with is like a record label, such as in the 80s, 4AD, where with the Pixies and the Throne Muses and sort of on college radio, people would go out and buy a 4AD record, irrespective of who the group was, simply because it's published by 4AD. Whereas some people will go out and buy an Angry Robot book simply because it's published by Angry Robot, because they know that they're going to get something challenging and hip and new, rather than, you know, rather than going to just sort of dipping their hand at random on the bookshelf. They know that that particular publisher really gives a damn about what they're publishing.
Yeah, and I think that's very true. And Angry Robot is a perfect example of a British publisher who I may not like everything they publish because there are certain kinds of books that are not my thing, but enormously, like when I look at their list, I go, oh, that looks good. That looks good. That looks good. It's a long sea of that look good, you know. And everything that I've read from them, I've loved. I mean, Paul S. Kemp, they did an Andy Remick book, which I had so much fun with. That was the crazy Clockwork Vampires was insane. And it was really cool and it was really exciting and well done. But it's another one of those moments. Like, basically, I think this whole podcast has just become like, let's just, you know, lob praise at British publishing in genre because it's doing wonderful things and we love you all.
I mean, you know, just to throw a little, you know, water on the fire of British love here. I mean, you know, I mean, there's some bad stuff being published over there too, and you know, even some of the big authors. I hate to say this on China Mielville, but Rail C sucked, dude.
Oh,
I was like, come on, you hacked it out. But that's just my opinion.
That one did seem to come out rather quick.
It, you know, I kept as I'm reading that book, I'm like going, my God, this could have been great if you'd put it through another draft. But that's just me.
Although it was the latest and hottest some time ago, I had problems with Embassy Town, to be perfectly honest. Some things just did not work for me in that novel. It felt more like he was playing with these ideas and playing with these themes rather than actually engaging with, say, characterization and plot.
Yeah.
I mean, it's brilliant, but it's flawed brilliance.
Yeah. Well, that was the same with Rail C. Brilliant. Well put. Brilliant, but flawed brilliance. But I digress. But, you know, there's just amazing things happening on the British science fiction scene right now. And among them, Gareth, I'm looking forward to Ack Macaque. Have you? So you've turned in the final version. The novel's all ready to go, right?
Yeah, I believe it actually went to print this week. So.
Oh, excellent. Excellent.
He's going to be a guest on this show again. just thought I'd throw that out there about how excited I am to read that book and have you on again.
Well, if you like, you can always have the monkey as a guest. He's always
I say get the monkey. Yeah, he has his own Twitter account, you know.
Yeah, he swears a lot, but he's always up for talking.
Oh my God.
That was hilarious. Okay, now, so
I got a question for Gareth, if you don't mind.
Sure, go for it.
Yeah.
Now this is, this is a little sad, but it's been about a year since Colin Harvey passed, and I always I'd heard that he helped you. I saw where you wrote that he helped you, or inspired you to complete your second novel, The Recollection.
Yeah.
I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about that. I mean, I never got a chance to meet Colin Harvey in person, but we can, you know, communicate quite a bit online. He was one of the first people to, you know, give me some favorable reviews to my writing. So, I mean, you know, it hit me and I didn't even know him. So I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about him and how he helped your novel and all that.
Yeah, sure. Last weekend we had, I was luckily enough to be guest of honor at the fourth BristolCon convention in the lovely city of Bristol in the UK. I recommend you all visit it as soon as possible. BristolCon itself was pretty much the brainchild of Colin, who liked, when he was sitting in a pub with like-minded sci-fi fans, to cause trouble. And the way he caused trouble was to nudge people and say things like, you know what we should do? We should run a convention. And then sit back with a big smile on his face and watch as everybody ran around like headless chickens. But at this convention, we had an hour-long sort of celebration of Colin. He was listed on the program as the Ghost of Honor because it was his idea, and he was a brilliant bloke. He was a good writer. He had two good novels out. Winter Song, Damage Time, his two last big novels. But he was also a good friend. And he had so much enthusiasm and so much time for everybody. He encouraged everybody that he ever met, I think, to write. And what he did for me was I went to a convention and I met up with an agent who was semi-interested in me at the time. And I said, look, I've got this novel I'm writing about, you know, spaceships and a London taxi driver who accidentally falls 400 years into the future into a space opera. And the agent just looked at me like I'd embarrassed myself and said, well, go away and write me something commercial. So I was a bit taken aback because I thought this novel was, you know, it was the novel I'd wanted to write since I was 12 years old. This was every space opera I'd ever written crammed into one book. And I got in the car on the way home from the convention feeling very down. And Colin said, screw him. He said, if you want to write the book, write the book. So I wrote the book. And it was taken up by Solaris and printed, without the help of an agent, and printed. And, you know, everything followed on from that. But it was very much, I was on the point of giving up there. And Colin got me to carry on. And it was very ironic that Colin died a couple of days before the book was published. And in fact, the book launch was the day before his funeral. So it was a bit of a funny time. But yeah, very much appreciated his help there. And he's a big loss to UK genre fiction. He was always a face at every convention. And through his work through the Codex up-and-coming writers discussion forum online, he touched a lot of writers around the world as well. So yeah, very sadly missed.
Thanks, Jason.
Yeah.
Didn't mean to bring everybody down. I was thinking about him the other day, you know, and just kind of popped in and wanted to ask you about him. Anybody who's listening to this, I would highly recommend checking out Colin's novels, it's a shame he passed. I felt like he was on his way up, and he passed at a bad time, you know, because, but still, he left some great science fiction out there. So look for his writings, and I think you'll enjoy what you find.
Absolutely. He's published through Angry Robot, correct?
Correct.
Yeah, I thought so. I remember. Yeah.
Yeah, because Angry Robot did that special, that donation special. Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah. But, wow. So I don't know where you go from here.
Yes, well, I guess I kind of brought the whole conversation down there. Okay. You know, that's a specialty of mine, by the way.
I mean, that's I appreciate that the touching aspect of this, though. I mean, in serious terms, you know, when you have a relationship with somebody, such as Gareth had with Colin Harvey. I mean, it is nice to get those kinds of stories out so that we don't forget what those people right. were like. Because, I mean, in genre, I mean, we're talking about writers who most of the time, with the exception of these moments when we're talking on a podcast, right, you spend your days, if you don't have a day job, sitting in a home by yourself, maybe with a cat, right, who can't tell stories about you. So it is good to get that out so that we remember, so we have some kind of a record of who these people are for posterity, you know, so people can go back and go, oh, that guy, you know, that's who that person was, right? You know, I mean, there's all this kind of talk about all the letters and stuff from all these classic writers, right? We understand somewhat of who they were, even way back when, in like the 50s, when there really weren't a lot of conventions, and these writers never really met. They wrote letters to each other. Now we write emails, but yeah, so.
But you know, it's also, you know, what Gareth was talking about the, and what we've all been talking about, you know, the type of literary tradition in Britain or in the United States, all of that is carried forward by the people involved in it. You know, I'm about to let out my inner anthropologist. I apologize in advance, but it's cultural memes. It's culture. It's, you know, it's how we all act and in the ideas and beliefs that we carry forward. And people like Colin Harvey, really touched a lot of writers, even a lot of writers who did not meet him in person. And he made a huge impact on the genre, even though most people may not know his name. And there's people like that throughout the genre history. And I think, you know, it's important to not forget what they've done. I mean, just the fact that, you know, Gareth, for your second novel, that, you know, maybe you would have finished it, maybe you would not have, but, you know, just that, you know, one conversation you had with him, you know, that's, you know, then multiply that times all the conversations Colin had with so many people. You know, it's, you know, I don't mean to bring people down, because it's sad that he passed, but I mean, it's glorious what the lives and the writing that he touched. And it's, yeah. You know, it's people helping talk. It's those kind of touches that, you know, build up in the culture of our genre where we can create great science fiction and great literature.
I'd just like to say as well that every other writer of science fiction and fantasy and horror that I've ever met has been incredibly helpful. With one exception, I'm not going to name who that was.
dirt, no.
But yeah, it's so supportive. You go to, I've only been to British cons. I've never made it over across to an American con. But every con I've been to, you go up to a writer, and it's like going up to a fellow fighter pilot in a bar. It's, you know, you buy each other a drink, have a bit of a brag about who you shot down recently, and. You know, you're all looking out for each other. You're all helping each other. You go on Twitter and say, oh, God, I need a book about so-and-so, and five of them will write back immediately and go, try reading this one. It just seems to be the way it is. It's which I think, I don't know if that translates across into other genres where, especially sort of mainstream, I've sensed online a little more competition, a little more kind of territorial flashing of the antlers and the teeth.
Wasn't a couple years ago MD Lachlan had said something like that about, was it mystery or crime fiction, something like that, about how you know, nobody really wanted to help get, they treated everything like a competition, so no. Talking to you about your book, that was like, no, I'm talking to the enemy. If they sell books, that means I don't sell books, that's evil. And then he wrote a fantasy novel and he suddenly got all these emails from people, and he's talking to these people, and they're going, I loved your novel. Like, wait, that's really cool. And they would talk about his novel and be really excited about his book. And he was like, I don't know how to respond to this because I've grown up in this culture where it doesn't do this. So
and a lot of the, I like to think, say a lot of the literary world is much like the academic world, where it's the knives come out and they want to just, you know, if you try to, you can't succeed, because if you succeed, it's going to hurt me. So I'm going to take you down. And thankfully, science fiction and fantasy, and I, has avoided that to a large degree. I do want to say the horror genre seems to be a bit like that. I don't write much horror, but I know quite a few horror writers, and they seem to have a similar attitude.
It's much less a zero-sum game in science fiction and fantasy than in other literary genres. I do think so. And M.D. Lachman is another example of that, crossing the boundaries in the U.K. I mean, writing mysteries and others and academic stuff, and then going and starting with his Wolf's Angel series.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's just a weird thing. Gareth lives in a great place, man. Just saying.
Hell yeah.
Like he's going to come on here and trash the UK. He's enjoying his life over there with your crazy socialist healthcare. And I'm just teasing. teasing. Anywho, okay, so just, we had a second topic, but we're just going to do it super quick. We're only going to get one example from each person. Because I want to make sure that Gareth can sleep at a reasonable hour. So our second topic was futures that terrify us. But instead of talking about these in length, we're just going to each give one brief account of a future that terrifies the hell out of us. And then we'll let everybody else kind of think about how terrifying that is for Halloween. So, Paul?
Seed by Rob Ziegler comes to mind. It's a future dominated by bad climate change, people, hardscrabble existence, totalitarian overtones, a really nasty piece of work, but really well written piece of work. You don't want to live there, but you can. But Ziegler really evokes that future that I do not want very, very well indeed.
All right, Gareth?
I'm tempted just to answer with two words, one of which is Romney.
No! Politics free.
Okay. I think so. In other, I will go probably with the Wind-Up Girl.
Oh, yeah.
Which, if you've read it, is it's a future where everything is just completely fucked. And they are reliant on clockwork, and they've had to invent this kind of spring to store clockwork energy in order to power anything. And when they're not using clockwork, they're using genetically modified giant elephants. And it's just horrible. And everyone in the book is racist. Everyone in the book is out for themselves. Nobody gives a shit about anything. And they're just all trying to screw each other over. And, up until about halfway they are, because that's about as far as I got before I threw the book across the room and couldn't take it anymore. It's just such a horrible, nightmarish future. That would be mine.
Awesome. All right, Jason?
Well, actually, I'm going to have to pick the same future, except I'm not going to say the Wind-Up Girl. I'm going to say Paolo Bacigalupi's. Any future he writes is the future I don't want to live in. I love Paolo's writing, though. I love the Wind-Up Girl, even though it was horrid. The future. His short stories, his young adult novel, Shipbreaker, all of those futures are not a future I'd want to live in. But I think he even agrees with that. I've met him a few times, and I know he signed one of his books for me once, saying, "I hope we have a better future than this." So I think even he wants it to be better than that. I will say, though, one thing, a story I read just a few days ago, Ken Liu's The Waves, which is in the December 2012 Asimov's. It's one of my favorite stories of the year so far. It's very much a story of the singularity, far future and all of that. And it shows the changes that humanity goes through as it becomes less human, but also while remaining human. And I have to admit, the story disturbed me because it showed people losing what I consider core aspects of their humanity. And that disturbed me at the time. And I was like, well, you know, what happens, happens. So, in some ways, I guess a future where we lose the aspects of of humanity that we have now, which just disturbs me. But, people will do what they want to do. We won't be around for these futures. So, I guess people who come after will just have to decide if they like them or not. If they don't, they'll have to change them.
I will resurrect you, Jason, and you can be that old grumpy guy that doesn't like the direction the world has gone.
When I'm an old grumpy guy, I'm just going to have a gun and shoot people if I'm grumpy. I think what we need more in the world are people who are like, I'm at the end of my life. I'm going to take some jerks with me No, I'm just... Bad joke.
See, only in America can you say that, because Gareth is like, oh, guns? What are you talking about? I don't have that crap over here.
No, we don't have guns. We have sarcasm.
See, and that's actually a much worse weapon if you're not careful.
Yeah, it can destroy you socially, and that is much worse than being shot.
That's true. What is the name of that guy who goes to the European Union and always insults everybody?
That would be our glorious Prime Minister.
isn't there another guy, like a Nigel something?
Oh, Nigel Farage.
Yeah. Is he the one that insults Belgium all the time?
Yes, he's. I think he's under the delusion he's some kind of politician, where he's actually just an exchange program that's gone wrong.
I love him. I just gotta say, like, what I love about him is that even though he's insulting people, he does it in this way that it just, the way he plays with language is just, I just love it. I love watching him. Like, when he called Belgium a non-country, I was like, oh, I have nothing against Belgium, but I just found that really amusing.
So. I like the way he thinks he really passionately believes he's speaking on behalf of the majority of the UK, and the majority of the UK is looking at him on TV and going, what?
Oh, I love you. I love that.
Well, okay. Trust me, in 2 weeks, the world will have a chance to either go, oh, that was a good result, or what? There's going to be a lot of, there's a 50-50 chance there's going to be a lot of whats around the world in 2 weeks, you know, after the U.S. presidential election is over. We'll just have to wait and see.
Indeed.
Well, that's the date when we find out whether we're living in Philip K. Dick's future or J.G. Ballard's.
Very true. Well put.
Yeah, it's very well put. All right. My I was gonna go with an example of a zombie future, such as like the Reapers or the Angels. But then I realized I'd actually kind of like that future because I've been preparing for the zombie apocalypse for like 5 years now, which is maybe a little strange. So I'm gonna go with Lost Everything by Brian Francis Slattery, which. Okay. I don't know how to describe it. It's basically the United States goes to pot as a result of what seems to be some sort of climate disaster and a civil war in which nobody knows why they're fighting each other. They're just killing each other and anyone who gets in their way because they're desperate for something. And it's a gloomy, horrible place to live. It's a beautiful book, but I would not want to live there.
You know, I do have to say there is a... I have to I'm blanking on the, here, hold on, let me grab my book. There is one book I want to mention as a, you know, horrible future. Oh yeah, sorry about that, I had to grab it. Have y'all heard of This Is the Way the World Ends by James Morrow?
Yes.
Yeah,
that book effed me up when I was younger. You know, nuclear apocalypse, and then, you know, the ghost of the people who were never born put some survivors on trial and then killed them too. And oh yeah, that's one of those books that just messes you up.
Okay, so I should probably not read it.
Yeah, no, you should. It's a great book. You should read it. It's yeah.
I actually gotta. We'll leave after. I just want to tell a funny story. What happened today? So my students in my American Lit class were reading James Baldwin's Going to Meet the Man. If you've never read this story, it involves a very violent lynching in the story, involving certain body parts of being cut off. I'll just leave it at that detail. And that day, one of my students, who is like 8 months pregnant, and so she had her son with her today, carrying her bag. And so she brought him to class, and I first thought was, of all the days you would bring your young son to my class, you would bring it on the day in which we are discussing a lynching. And so it was a very interesting experience trying to tiptoe around this story and also kind of not scar this child for life. I'm pretty sure I've scarred the child.
But that's okay. We need more scarring for life. I mean, that, personally, I think that's a problem. I mean, I'm going to go out on a limb and say, I'm being serious here, actually. A lot of the problems, at least in the United States, are people have it too good. And you got this whole class of people who have never had any issues in their life. They never had any struggles. Everything's been handed to them. And worst of all, they think they earned it all themselves. They it's like that famous quote from Ann Richards about George W. Bush. You know, he was born on third base and thought he hit a triple. So sometimes I wonder, is maybe we could use a little more scarring. You know, maybe then if there's a little more scarring, people might actually go, wow, there's more to life than just my own desires and wants and needs. Well, but such is life.
To be fair, 100 years ago, she probably just would have taken her son to an actual lynching.
Oh, very true.
Yeah.
This is true. Although very the true. Student is from Uganda, so pretty sure she wouldn't have taken her son to a lynching.
Possibly not, but there has been some progress made.
Indeed, yeah.
And that is the big thing, remember. There's a...
Just the fact that she's a student is a big step forward.
Absolutely. No. And a student from Uganda, no less,
yeah,
who's come to America and is getting a college degree and has children and is... This student is amazing. Like, anytime any student, like an 18-year-old student from high school, comes to me and says, this class is so hard because I got to read 20 pages a day, I'm like, you know what? I had a student whose kid had cancer, who had to go to, like, 5 surgeries in the same semester. She was pregnant. She had 2 other kids at home, was married. And yet this student managed to show up to class and did all of her work.
You know,
just saying.
There's a great... nonfiction book, which I think a lot of people have now heard of it at least, but if you haven't read it, everyone should read it. It's by Steven Pinker. He's a professor of psychology at Harvard University. It's called The Better Angels of Our Nature, Why Violence Has Declined. And it's very convincing. Basically, it shows, you know what, you go back in history, we were much more violent than we are now. It was a nasty world. I mean, so anyone who says that we're so violent these days, you know what? We were nothing like our ancestors, and that we were nothing like our ancestors' ancestors. The further back you go, the more horrid and violent humanity was. So we've been, in his premise is, and I think he makes the case very well, that we've been domesticating ourselves. We've been, you know, basically over time, humanity has been becoming much less violent. But, yeah, so you go back in time, you know, anyone who ever says, oh, I wished I lived back in the Roman ages or in the 19th century. Yeah, no, you wouldn't. wouldn't.
No.
We've outsourced our violence.
Well, yeah, I mean, that is part of the problem. His point is overall. I mean, he's not saying that there's still not violent areas of the world or that we don't do violent things. But if you look at overall violence, you know, it has declined.
He bases it partly on statistical data that shows that there's actually a measured decline in the size of the violence essentially occurring.
Correct. That doesn't mean that horrible, violent things don't still happen. You know, he's not saying that. And it doesn't mean it won't happen in the future. But, you know, he definitely makes the case that, you know, the level of violence across the entire of humanity is much less today than it was 100 years ago, 200 so going so far back. It's a great book to read. It's very thought-provoking.
Cool. Oh, sorry, Gareth, did you want to add?
Sorry, I was just going to say, weirdly, I was reading about that earlier this evening in an interview with David Brin in InterZone, I think. He was talking about the same book, his new book as well, how that's informed a lot of the ideas of his new latest.
Oh, interesting.
Now, that's very interesting. Yeah, I'll have to check that out.
I didn't know that.
Cool. So, all right. So, just so we can get Gareth in bed in time in a reasonable hour, you know, because I know in England you have to get up at 6 in the morning, you know, have your proper tea in the morning and all these things. And
yeah, second breakfast.
Yep. Just like hobbits. Hobbits. Yep.
Teasing. That's right. Go for the full stereotype here, but that's okay.
Hey, I love British people, so.
I've got a busy day of scouring the Shire to do tomorrow.
Anywho, so where can people find you, Gareth?
Where can people find you? In England. But on the interwebs, www.garethlpowell.com.
Awesome. So everybody should go check him out. He's also, of course, on Twitter as I believe it's just Gareth L. Powell as well, right?
Yeah, I just keep the same name all the way through. Makes things a lot simpler.
And what is the monkey's name on Twitter?
The monkey's name is Ak-Ak-Makak, all one word. And I do warn you, though, he does swear like a stevedore.
Oh, no. Awesome, awesome. All right, and Jason, where can people find you?
Go to my website, jasonsanford.com. You can also just Google me, Jason Sanford. And like I said, I've got a new story coming up in InnerZone, so you want to go ahead and grab an issue of the November, December InnerZone. You'll see quite a good story, I hope. And you can find me on Twitter and Facebook, too.
Awesome. And awesome. Everybody, of course, knows where to find Paul because all of his information is on our website, so you should go to all of his stuff, too. So thank you both, Gareth and Jason, for being on our ridiculous show and babbling about all this cool stuff.
Hey, take care. Guys.
Cool. All right. See everybody on the flip side. If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google Plus.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
You're just another weak human afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction!
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
End of line.